It was just such an awesome thing to watch a team of over 900 people wrap their head around, this is a problem and we need to get back to normal and we need to do it as quickly as possible.
Welcome to the storm. I'm your host, Stuart Winchester, ducking into one of my favorite ski states today, as we check in on the team at the absolutely fabulous Sunday River Ski Area. First, a huge thank you to all of the paid subscribers to the Storm Skiing Journal and Podcast who are listening to this conversation 7 full days before everyone else. That is one of the many benefits of upgrading to paid, including just in general a lot more content focused on the ever-evolving world of lift-served skiing than you're getting right now. The article previews you're seeing are only about 20% of a typical Storm Skiing Journal article. To fully immerse yourself in the storm, you can help yourself to an upgrade, which comes with the intangible but enormous benefit of ensuring the future of ski journalism that is about more than stoke and bro culture. So, you know, the lift-served skiing universe that 99% of us actually inhabit and care about. So please head over to stormskiing.com where you can upgrade to the paid tier, or if you're not signed up at all, at least get in on the free version. You can also follow the Storm on the X platform or Instagram at stormskijournal. All right, let's talk about what is probably the most important part of my ski kit, Podtronics ski boot foot warmers and heated socks. You know I love skiing, but I hate having cold feet, and my feet are always cold, or, well, they used to be. They're not anymore. You know how I fixed it? I hooked myself up with Hottronic XLPC foot warmers in my ski boots. If you've had Hottronics before, you should know that the updated C series is the best on the market, with a new, larger anatomical shape, but with smaller, lighter batteries that perform in temperatures down to 22 degrees below zero, which, if you've ever skied Sunday River, you know is not at all hypothetical. Or if you're looking for a less intrusive solution, consider Hottronic XLP heated socks. These socks offer the best size to capacity ratio and longevity on the market, with up to 18 hours of continuous heating power, and they will fit into your existing ski boots without issue. And here's an awesome feature. This new generation of Hottronics products is Bluetooth enabled, meaning you can manage them from the Hottronic Heat app. It's time to ditch the tough guy mentality. Skiing should not be an exercise in managing discomfort. Hook yourself up with Hottronic boot warmers or heated socks this ski season. Click the link in the banner on the podcast article to get started. Episode 164, Brian Heon, General Manager of Sunday River, Maine. Longtime readers and listeners of The Storm know I am tremendously fond of Sunday River. There are a couple reasons for this. The most obvious is that it's a damn good ski area, sprawling and interesting, with amazing terrain variety and an ever-improving snowmaking and lift system. But it's also, frankly, run by really good people who bailed me out when I busted my leg into pieces 2 years ago in Maine, even though I wasn't skiing at their mountain when it happened. I was down the road at Black Mountain of Maine, whose patrol, I'll say, did an incredible job stabilizing me and getting me safely off the mountain, and gave me a whole new appreciation for ski patrol and their training and competence. But when me and my minivan were stranded 7 hours from home, it was an assist from the team at Sunday River that helped get me back home to my couch, where I spent the next half year recovering. But the hospitality and kindness at Sunday River are just reflections of the culture of the ski area and of Maine as a whole, which are, in general, extremely welcoming places, at least from my experience. There's a reason I keep going back to Maine and back to Sunday River, both to ski and to talk about skiing on this podcast. Let's go. My guest today has been General Manager of Sunday River, Maine since 2020, with more than 1,000 acres of trails and glades on a 2,350-foot vertical drop. Sunday River is one of the largest ski areas in the eastern United States. Sunday River is served by one of the largest lift fleets in New England, with 19 lifts, including two brand new Doppelmayr D-Line lifts installed over the past 2 years. Prior to joining the team at Sunday River, he acted as general manager of Wildcat New Hampshire for 7 years. He is also a returning guest and a very good friend of the Storm. Brian Heon is my guest. Brian, always good to chat with you. How is life up in Maine today?
Stuart, thanks for having me. I love this. It's a beautiful day here in Maine today, and the skiing is phenomenal. So,
you know, Brian, you always bring great energy, and I want to keep that going, but I have to start with the events that happened in December, that big storm that hit Sunday River. It's in your rear view now. It was over a month ago, but take us back there for a moment. Exactly how much rain hit and how extensive was the damage to the resort?
Yeah, Stuart, it was the middle of December, and you know, I think things were trucking along. We were skiing from the Jordan to the summit. We'd brought Barker 6 had been open for 9 days. The forecast was for a couple inches of rain. And at the end of it, I think, depending on where you were at the resort, we got the average of about 7 to 8 inches of rain here at Sunday River.
Wow.
So,
wow. Do you have any sense of historic context for if you've ever had a rain event like that at Sunday River before?
Yeah, over the years, to that magnitude, that's a lot of rain, right? And you look at how quickly the rain fell, right? And that was within probably 10 to 12 hours. But then you also look at, you know, the ground was frozen, we had snow on the ground, you know, so when you get this in the summer, the resort and the mountain reacts much differently than it does when it's covered with snow and has frozen ground. So depending on the set of the environment really depends on kind of what happens to and where water runs. So it was an interesting time.
So you were expecting a couple inches. You got around 7 or 8, depending on where you look on the mountain. I mean, you can see these things coming, right? We have some pretty good technology these days. But until it hits, you never really know how bad it's going to be. What did you do when you saw this thing churning toward you on the radar? And when did it hit you that this wasn't just an average storm, but a really catastrophic event?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. It was probably about 10:30, 11 in the morning when, you know, the operations team on the hill was, we were having trouble keeping terrain open because we had open water flowing down trails, across trails. It was cutting off some access to lifts that you needed to kind of get from Southridge to the Jordan or vice versa. So it really started to kind of escalate pretty quickly. Another factor that we have here at Sunday River is just the level of the Androscoggin River and tributaries that flow into it. Those started to get really close to high water marks. They started to affect roads and access to the resort or getting close to that. And as we look at things like that at happening at 10 or 11 in the morning, knowing we've got more to come, that's when we kind of raised some flags that how is this really going to affect our operation?
Now, to be clear, you had actually preemptively closed the resort for that day, right? You didn't have skiers on the hill when this was happening.
No, we did. Yeah, we opened up the resort that day. And I think at about 11 o'clock, we pulled the plug on skiing for the day.
Okay. Did everyone get off okay? Was anyone caught up in any of those water bars or whatever they were?
No. I think, it was coming down pretty hard, Stuart. So we didn't have too many folks skiing that day. So when we did that, I think it was just kind of inevitable for the day.
So when something like this happens, Brian, and you're making this assessment that affects a lot of people, and Sunday River is a big place. Like anyone who's ever driven from the Jordan Hotel down to the main base knows that it's a big chunk of land. How much are you kind of on an island, so to speak, as a resort, and how much do you work with local or regional authorities to assess the kind of damages that are going on and the greater ripple of impacts of things like highway closures on your road? Just kind of take us in that war room for a minute and what it's like and how you get through and kind of assess what you should do next as a resort.
Right. So first and foremost, yeah, local authorities, seeing where they're at with local road closures. We go back and we start looking at the safety of the team and the guests. one of the beautiful things about Sunday River, we have a lot of support locally from contractors. We have some unbelievably skilled excavator operators and loader operators and things like that. So we like to think we can fix a lot of things, but our number one thing is making sure that the team and the guests at the resort are safe. And so that's kind of what we kind of hunkered down to, is making sure that people were inside, they were safe. We started to lose some roads here at the resort. I think, you know, we lost access to the Summit Hotel. So making sure that we had the right people in place at the Jordan, at the Summit, here at the resort, to look at things from an engineering perspective, an operational perspective. So I think, you know, the biggest thing is understanding the magnitude that is in front of us or that is potentially coming, and getting the right people in the right places to ensure that the guests and the team are safe.
So what can you tell us about that magnitude? How long did that storm last? And give us a high level view of the damage as much as you can in very broad terms.
Sure. So I think the storm lasted probably about 10 or 12 hours. By about 8 o'clock at that night, most of the rain had passed through the resort. But at that point in time, the resort was an island. You couldn't get to the resort. You couldn't get from the resort. The Summit Hotel was an island, right? We had guests trapped up there with, luckily, our hotel general manager was there. We had a bunch of cooks. We had some housekeepers. We had a maintenance team there. One of the saving graces, Stuart, in this storm is that we never lost power here at the resort. We have the ability to manage our own power, so we were able to shut off power to lifts and some of the infrastructure that we knew we weren't using. But it was really good that we never lost power at the Jordan or the Summit or here at Southridge, which made a lot of our things a little bit easier. You know, you could charge your cell phone, we could have radio communication that has been repeated. So we had some things kind of going for us, although we were stranded here at the resort and we had some major infrastructure damage. So
are you on the grid or do you have backup stuff? What's your power situation there?
Yeah, we are on the grid. We do have some backup at both hotels, so that's always nice to have. But we can also, we have a very large electrical infrastructure. We have the ability to kind of manage that. So there's some stuff that we can turn off preventatively. Some of our chairlifts, our snowmaking system. So we kind of shut that stuff down, but was able to keep grid power going to both hotel properties. So
it sounds like a lot of damage toward the base of the mountain and some of the surrounding infrastructure, the roads, et cetera. How about the ski infrastructure? And I don't want to lump this in because I know it's not on the important scale, but the snowpack, because you had blown a lot of snow. Just talk about the shape of the ski hill itself and everything that serves it after the storm.
Yeah, we definitely lost some snow, right? I mean, I think it was 40 degrees and 7 inches of rain will eat snow pretty quick. You know, we had some culverts on the hill that kind of were overwhelmed, so that kind of cut in on some of the ski trails a little bit. Most across the board, our infrastructure was pretty well protected. Snowmaking certainly had a little bit of a slower startup when we got to snowmaking, just to kind of double check some systems were in place and they weren't too affected by flooding. The same thing with our lift infrastructure. But we got really lucky with a lot of our major infrastructure when it came to electricity, as well as snowpack. We certainly had some areas of snowpack that were lost, especially, you know, at the bottom of the hill where the water tended to collect. But once we got back into the snowmaking aspect of it, we were able to get snowmaking back up to 100% of our capacity, which really helped us in the recovery.
So you were closed to tend to all that for 4 days. Doesn't sound like a lot in hindsight. I imagine at the time it felt like an eternity, especially when you're just trying to get going for that December ski season. You got Christmas in your sights and the last thing you need is a big obstacle in the way to jump over. So it was really a fast recovery, all things considered. But going back to that day, Brian, when the storm cleared and you're on the ground, how did you and the team prioritize recovery efforts to get Sunday River moving again?
Right. You think about it, and I appreciate the fact that it feels like forever, because Stuart, it did, right? I mean, we're right before Christmas. We got a lot of momentum. Snowmaking's going. The team's, you know, growing by the day. We're trying to fire on all cylinders and create this unbelievable guest experience for Christmas. And then all of a sudden you have a little bit of a setback. So 4 days of closure felt like just an eternity when you look at how the team likes to kind of get up and go and get momentum for the Christmas holiday. But coming back to it, I think, you know, we quickly prioritized and did things by pod or by basin, right? You've got Whitecap, Barker, Southridge, Aurora there, kind of in between Southridge and Jordan, and then looking at the Jordan. We also assessed, you know, how our snowpack was. We knew how our snowpack was prior to the event, right? We knew we had a bunch of snow at Jordan. We would just opened up Barker, so we had a bunch of snow in Barker. You know, we were going towards the Whitecap area, so we know we had a little less snow out there, but that's where we were kind of focusing our efforts next. So kind of round after the storm, rounding up and getting assessment of where we were after the storm compared to kind of how we knew we were building our snowpack was how the team went to look at, okay, well, we know we had a bunch of snow in Barker. Can we get the Barker Basin open again? We knew we had a bunch of snow in Jordan, but we had some blowouts on Lollapalooza, so we weren't sure if we could get skiing in and out of the hotel. So maybe that's second priority because we knew we could get Barker up and going. So just really, you know, dividing our mountain into pods, as we say, and then, you know, prioritizing where we can get skiing back as soon as possible.
How about the base area infrastructure, the roads, the access to the hotel? I mean, all of that had to be fixed before you could even get to the mountain, right? Or were you doing all that simultaneously?
Yeah, simultaneously. So the road coming into Sunday River was down to one lane. We lost half the road going in, and the town was promptly working on that as they prioritized roads and bridges throughout our town. And we did the same thing here. We knew we lost egress to the Summit Hotel. So that was kind of a number one priority for us. So how we could get folks in there. Luckily, our ops team had a bunch of connections with we had a temporary bridge in there for a little bit. And then we were able to pivot off of that and get a bigger culvert in there. But, you know, access for that was certainly first and foremost on our mind.
I mean, that bridge story is really impressive. Let's focus on that for a minute. So the Summit Hotel, you have to cross a little bridge to get there. What happened to that bridge? And then just talk us through the process, how you were able to replace that so quickly. Because a bridge is no joke when you think about the size of a modern vehicle. And I don't know if you were still running shuttle buses over it, but it has to be trusted with quite a bit.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, we lost complete access there. There were two culverts that were underneath the paved road, and those culverts got overwhelmed. So eventually the water overflowed them and then just eroded all the earth around the culverts, you know, brought that downstream, and then infinitely the culverts went with it. So after that had slowed down, we knew we had to get that access open as soon as possible. Luckily, we had some connections. We brought in a logging bridge. So there we have a connection with a logger in New Hampshire who does a lot of work on Forest Service property, and he has some of these bridges that they put in remotely. So we were able to contact him, and within, I think, the next day after the storm, he was loading it on to a truck and getting the bridge here on property. So great partnership there.
What's the state of that today? Have you been able to build a new permanent bridge? Are you just kind of getting through the season with what you can?
No, so that was a temporary solution just to allow access for guests to leave, emergency vehicles, and things like that. We then quickly pivoted to another contractor and said, you know what, we need to put something in here that's going to long-term, meaning get us through the rest of the season. So about a week after that, we pivoted. We put about a 10-foot diameter culvert in there, and then we have a dirt road that goes over that. And that's two lanes in each direction. It allowed for vehicle traffic. It allowed for the Cisco truck to get there. It allowed for our buses to get there. So that really opened up that hotel back to kind of 100%. Now ahead, that will, you know, we're in the spring, we're going to look at paving, and is that the final solution? So we're still working through that now.
So it sounds like you patched everything back together as well as you could. One feature of the mountain that I'm pretty curious about, Brian, is this big snowy igloo. And I was talking to Boyne Resort CEO Stephen Kircher when I was out at Big Sky for the tram opening. He was really excited about this igloo. He was also very concerned, by the way, for Sunday River, and the tram happened to open the day after the storm. So he was very locked in, as I'm sure you know, to what was going on. But he's very excited about this igloo. So tell us about that and how it managed through the storm.
Yeah, Stuart, you got to come and experience it. It's so hard to describe that igloo. I guess I haven't found a way to convey the awesomeness that this igloo has as a guest experience. It's really hard to do. Certainly concerned about that, right? It is a lot of snow. It got a lot of rain on it, but that igloo survived extremely well.
And that's over by the Jordan Lift?
Yeah, it's right in the base of Jordan.
And who you brought in someone from Europe to build that, right?
Yeah. So there's a gentleman has a company over there, and he's been building them for 20 to 25 years. And I think Stephen had experienced that with Alpen Igloo in Europe. And the owner came over here and just brought in so much excitement and so much skill to how to build this, to how to help the team do it, to work with the team and, you know, eventually get us to just this really unbelievable guest experience, which is just, you know, it's a 3-room igloo with hallways that connect all the rooms to each other. It's got seating inside. It's got a bar inside. It's got lights inside. It's awesome. It's a really neat thing.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
All cool. Right. So let's zoom out here a little bit, Brian. I think that it's easy to get swept away in the big media narratives. And I think when something like this happens, it immediately gets turned into a climate change is killing skiing story, which is an easy story and I think a lazy story. Because when I look at this from 6 weeks later, what I see is a resort that had really done a lot to climate proof itself and make itself very resilient in the event of an extreme weather event like this. Now, that's not to say that there's no climate change happening or that it's not making your job harder. But I do think that Sunday River and other resorts are doing a nice job of anticipating the worst of Mother Nature and getting themselves ready so they can not only withstand it, but then recover quickly from it. That's me. That's me looking here from the outside, from the sidelines. For you, Brian, who's there on the resort every day and who's doing all this work, when something like this happens, does it reinforce your belief that Sunday River is ready for whatever comes next climate-wise? Does it highlight how much work you still have to do? Does it make you worried that maybe you can't do this forever? Kind of where's your head at with that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things we do to protect our team, our guests, our resort, our infrastructure. And we're always looking at how we pivot and manage that. In this situation, we certainly got a lot of rain. There were some kind of extenuating circumstances with frozen ground and a snowpack that maybe had a crust layer on it, so it wasn't absorbing the rain the way it should have. I think the true testament in getting through, let's just talk specifically about a rain event like we did, is teamwork, right? The mountain ops team, our engineering team, the resort as a whole, it was just such an awesome thing to watch a team of over 900 people wrap their head around this is a problem and we need to get back to normal and we need to do it as quickly as possible. And as quickly as possible, as safe as possible, taking care of our team first. So, you know, it's just whatever the event is, I think that getting a team of people that can work through that together, whether it's a rain event, a snow event, a flood event, a lightning event, a power outage event, right? All these things that are thrown at a mountain operations team. So just a lot of excitement there. You know, on the snowmaking side of things, we are constantly looking to be more efficient. And that's more efficient with taking advantage of smaller windows to make snow in, right? And whether we've got 8 hours or 80 hours, how can we have the best equipment to help us maximize what we want to do in that time frame? And when it comes to snowmaking, it's low E guns, it's having systems in place, really nice control system, it's having automation, it's having guns that have weather stations on them. So every situation we try to protect the core and we try to protect our business and what we do and what we offer our guests so we can get there as fast as possible.
To what extent when something like this happens, I mean, to what extent are you on your own? To what extent is insurance able to step in? I mean, this is an event that to a lesser resort or maybe to Sunday River 35 years ago might have ended the season, right? Because it is so deep and catastrophic. But you have all this experience and I imagine you also have a little bit of reinforcement. So kind of what protections does Sunday River have beyond that experience and infrastructure, just to make sure that this isn't one storm that ends your whole winter.
Right. I think, and that's where the power of Blend Resorts comes in. I think not only from a support perspective, we do have insurance, and that's got a multitude of different avenues that we go through insurance for. So you know, we've set ourselves up for protection when it comes to that. And I think, you know, having the support of Stephen Kircher, our COO groups, our senior vice presidents, there's a sense of support there that I think is really awesome. And I think it's really felt here at the resort level. So although we were like, oh my gosh, we've got a lot to do, the resources and support that we have, I think really comforts us when it's a time, even as such as grand as that we had.
Yeah, I think it's a huge help. But you know, you can throw money at anything, and that doesn't mean it's going to work. What I've always been impressed by with New England, Brian, and I remember when Hurricane Irene came through in 2011, and people in Vermont just started getting out their machinery and started fixing the roads, right? They weren't waiting for the road crews to come through. And I think there's just this New England grit and this just initiative that is not necessarily present in every region of the country or the world. So just having worked all over the country, what sets folks in New England apart from that point of view of just when they have a problem, they don't wait for help, they just start fixing the problem?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I had a lot of flashbacks to Irene, because when Irene hit, I was at Mount Snow in southern Vermont, which was probably only second worst to Killington when Irene hit. So I certainly had some flashbacks to that, and a lot of the same flashbacks to, oh my gosh, this is terrible, but it's that work ethic, right? That okay, we just got to get this done, right? We've got a challenge in front of us. We've got, and going back to what I said, like we making sure that the team is safe, our guests are safe, because we've got, like I said, we got a lot of resources. We've got excavators. We know people with excavators and dump trucks, but making sure that that team is safe and able to get here, that's what's going to move the needle in a situation like this, is the skill set of the folks we work with and the contacts that we have in our community. And it's just, you know, getting that group together as soon as possible and getting that it can be done attitude the next morning and getting them here and safe, that's where the real power is.
So were you, just curious, were you at the resort throughout the storm? Did you go home and have to get back in? I know you said you lost the road. Kind of, what was your personal circumstance?
Yeah, it was my day off.
Oh,
and
wow.
At about 10:30 in the morning, my phone was going off, the text message, the team's messaging. And I was like, boy, this is going pretty fast here. So I got to the resort at about 11 o'clock. At about 1 o'clock, my only road to get home got flooded out. So I called my wife, and her and the girls were fine. So just away I went to work, right? So I got here Monday morning, and I was able to get home late Tuesday once the road opened back up. So,
and what was the situation in town? Did the schools close during the storm, or did they not even open because they knew how bad it was going to be? Kind of, what was things like around Bethel in the area?
Yeah, as I remember, it was a very early dismissal for the kids at school. And I think that had to do with rising rivers and tributaries. The Androscoggin was getting pretty high pretty fast. The Sunday River was getting pretty high pretty fast, and a lot of tributaries. And historically, when that happens, there are points in town that the roads start to get flooded. So a lot of the schools started to kind of send the kiddos home for the day. So,
all right. Well, sounds like everyone made it through safe, which is great. But let's move on to the good news. It sounds like you moved through the storm okay. Barker 6. This lift, I wasn't able to make it to the opener. Thank you for the invitation, but I will get up there soon enough. The lift looks beautiful. It is your second Doppelmayr D-line lift in 2 years, which in and of itself is amazing. It replaced the old Barker, which was a frustration point for skiers, as I'm sure you were aware. Tell us about the new Barker lift, Brian, and how happy you are with this thing 6 weeks in.
Yeah, it's running really well for us. Just what another great addition to our lift system here at the resort. So, you know, uphill capacity, I think we're at probably another 1,000 people uphill per hour with that machine. 6 meters per second, six pack. You know, the signature red bubble, the heated seats, the contour seating, the loading conveyor, suspension on chairs. It's just another home run, we feel, for a guest experience, as well as just how people move and ski the resort.
So Barker has traditionally been a pinch point. Everyone just converged on that lift, and it would get some pretty hefty lift lines. Has that extra capacity helped to mitigate those lift lines a little bit?
Yeah, I certainly feel it has. We pivoted the bottom terminal, if you're standing at the bottom looking uphill, to the looker's right, I guess, mm-hmm. or the right-hand side by about 35 or 40 feet. So it gave a completely different feel to that base area and how we build the maze for that lift. So we're not skiing around both sides of the pond down there anymore. So it brought everybody onto the base lodge side of that, which really opened up our ability to cue people differently. But we knew we had to do that with the adding that uphill capacity. Having people come in both sides just really wasn't the way we wanted to go in cueing for that lift.
No, and I was so relieved, because as a skier, I really hate double-sided loading, because no one knows how to manage it. And if there's no one there, like an aggressive attendant there to manage them, it just turns into a free-for-all and you end up getting one person on a six-person chair. And it's not a good situation. So when you were deciding that, I mean, how much was it a desire to get away from that loading from both sides?
That was a big part of the decision to move that over. It really was. And also, we wanted to get away, if we could, from sending loaded chairs up over that pond. We had a net there. We had ways to kind of help guests load properly. But, you know, taking that little bit of extra fear, I guess, if you, for better choice of words, but just out of that loading experience, right? You get on the chairlift, you're getting situated, and boom, you're over water, right? So if we were able to pivot the bottom of that, and I think that really just, it helped the maze, it helped the experience of loading. So I think those were the two driving factors to get that lift moved over a little bit at the bottom.
Have you ever excavated that pond? I bet that thing is full of poles and iPhones and goggles.
Right. Yeah. Hand warmers, the whole bits in there.
Yeah. So it'll be a nice archaeological dig someday. So with all that extra capacity, you're putting a lot more skiers on Barker every hour. Has that caused any overcrowding?
No, and I think that people, you know, there's some phenomenal terrain, right? That's the original terrain here at Sunday River. And it just to have that quicker turnaround time and more lap time in and more on snow time with that lift has been a huge home run. We certainly, when you get here, the unload of that machine is much different. There's a lot more space up there. The accessibility to different parts of the hill to then kind of go over to Jordan or go to Whitecap. So we're still seeing the demand for that terrain, but just people's accessibility off of that is really proven to be a crowd favorite.
So Barker, for those not as familiar with Sunday River, it actually loads just downhill from Lock, and in both lifts, you can see them from each other. I'm looking at your interactive trail map today, and we're recording this on a Tuesday, January 30th, and it doesn't look like Lock is running. Maybe your map's not right, but what sort of impact, if any, has that new Barker lift had on how frequently you run Lock, that Lock triple, and how often you use it and what you use it for?
Yeah, so Lock has typically been more of on a busier day or on a weekend lift when it comes to scheduling for that, just with the terrain that it accesses. And I think just when you come here, Stuart, there's a difference between the Lock chair and Barker 6. And I think you'll see that in the speed and the comfort, right? So I think just having that Barker machine be our main focus over there really works for us midweek.
So Barker 6 was a really nice surprise. When Sunday River announced the Jordan 8 lift a couple of years ago, the plan had been to take that old Jordan high-speed quad, completely refurbish it, as Boyne has done at other places around his portfolio, like Loon Mountain and the old Swift Current lift that's about to open at Sugarloaf for the West Mountain expansion. And essentially, Sunday River was planning to do the same thing. With Barker, we ended up instead with a high-speed six-pack. So take us through this evolution of how you initially decided to move that Jordan quad over and ultimately why you decided to go with a brand new D-line on Barker instead.
I think the success that we had with the Jordan 8 really finalized any new lift choice that we had moving forward. I think that putting a six place in and really at Barker and getting that uphill capacity a little bit better while also enhancing that guest experience with some of the comforts that come with a D-line was really foremost in our mind. It really was kind of a no-brainer decision to continue to go with the D-line, the reliability of that machine, as well as the comfort that comes with it.
So what happened to that Jordan quad?
Jordan quad is still here, and its future is to be determined.
So another feature of the new Barker, I believe, is it has automatic restraint bars. Is that right? And how have folks adjusted to that?
Yeah, it does have automatic restraint bars. So we do a contour load on that, Stuart, and that's kind of where you load on a 90 degree. You'll see when you arrive how that works. So, and that terminal is also a little bit longer. So it really, you know, we've got, I think it's like 9 or 10 seconds in between each chair, which is a long time when loading a detachable lift. And something that, another thing that we definitely consider, we look at the chair interval and what that experience looks like and how that will enhance the uphill capacity with less slows and less stops. But I think having that restraint bar, so you sit six people on the chair, which you're delivered out to a single load point with the conveyor, just like Jordan 8. And then the chair turns 90 degrees. And even before that chair starts to accelerate, guests have had a few seconds to sit down, to have their skis come off the ground, right? So they're comfortably in their seat. The chair turns the corner, the bar goes down, and then the chair starts to accelerate out of the terminal. So there is an infinite amount of time to just get situated, to get comfortable. And then we've got some really big signage there that says, you know, restraint bar will automatically lower.
Mm-hmm. What happens if some dude has his backpack and the restraint bar hits that?
Yeah, so there's a few different switches throughout the terminal that it'll go through, and it'll try again. And then if there is a situation, you know, a misload of some sort, the attendant is right there, and then they'll be able to stop the lift.
Nice. All right. Well, Barker 6 is an amazing machine. That's your headliner. But you actually built two chairlifts this summer. The second was a second lift off the backside of Merrill Hill, another triple chair. I was told that this lift is complete and ready to go, but it will not open until next ski season. So tell us about this lift and its current status and why we won't actually be spinning it until the 2024 to 25 ski season.
It's a fixed grip triple, a Doppelmayr lift. It's on the backside of Merrill Hill. So the bottom of it is kind of more over by our golf course side than the Southridge side. It's a little bit longer than the other Merrill Hill chairlift. And it's all part of our master plan to continue to develop Merrill Hill in the backside of it, which is going to be really neat. Have you been up on Merrill Hill?
No, I was there when I was there last year. I rode by the bottom of the lift, but it was one of those days when I was with my kids and I just couldn't find the window to ride it up there.
Right. Wait, when you come here, wait until you see the view from Merrill Hill in the perspective it gives you of every aspect of Sunday River is awesome, right? When you're on top of Merrill Hill, you can see over, you can see the top of White Heat. You can see all of Barker off the other side. You look across, you see the ridgeline of the Jordan Hotel. You can see the top of Jordan 8. And then if you look out the back, you get the golf course, you get the view of the Mahoosix. So it's really a really awesome perspective. Put a road system in over there. We've put bridges and ski in and ski out properties. So that's where the Merrill Hill development comes online, with all of those individual house lots being ski in and ski out accessible off of the two Merrill Hill lifts.
So folks can see the current Merrill Hill lift 19 on the trail map, and it serves a small pot of trails that you built threaded through all those homes. The new lift is not on the map yet. So give us some perspective here, Brian. If you ride to the top of lift 19, will the top of the new lift be there? And then which way do you ski, kind of off what's currently the backside forest? And just tell us about the trails, whatever you can, to help orient us to what the ski experience will be like back there.
Yeah, so the current lift 19, or the current Merrill Hill lift, goes up, I would call it, I guess, the east side of Merrill Hill, looking back towards Southridge and Barker and Whitecap. And so if you got off of that lift and you skied straight down the other side, you'd probably go about 200 yards and you run into the top of the other lift coming up 180 degrees from, I'd say, more the west side of Merrill Hill, the golf course side of it. So they make both sides of Merrill Hill accessible via lift.
So Merrill Hill is a really cool little peak. And I think that it's underrated in the context of it's probably your smallest peak by vertical. I don't know, maybe Little White Cap is smaller, but what it has been marketed as is as a real estate development. And I realize it's an important part of your business, but what it strikes me as is a really nice little family and beginner hill where you can kind of get away from the crowds. And Sunday River has always had some really great beginner terrain on South Ridge, but Merrill Hill is away from those crowds. And it seems like people haven't really figured it out yet that it's there for the most part. So have you seen people using it for that? And has it taken any pressure off South Ridge, or people still just not know it's there?
No, I think they know it's there. And I think there's, you know, it's new, so I got to go check it out. Right. And that's what initially drives guests over there. But I think the next piece that they love about it is the views. There's been people that are skiing here for 25 years that have never looked back at Sunday River from that perspective. And it's really awesome. And then the third piece of it is you ride the new lift. It's a great lift. You get to the top, you check out the views. But I would say most people make a couple runs over there. It is some really great intermediate skiing. And the views from around each corner are different, and the slope is good, and we have, you know, snow making on all of it over there. So the snow surface is good, the lift is nice. So I think once you're over there, people do say this is a great little pod.
So what's next for Merrill Hill? Is it gonna max out at two lifts? Is there room for a little learning center or carpet up there? Could you put a restaurant at the top? And what's your thinking long term after you get this new lift open next year?
Yeah, I think Merrill Hill is a two lift part of our resort. We have no other plans to put more lifts over there, more conveyors, no snow sports facilities or anything like that. Really focusing on that as a ski in and out property, accessible with 100% snowmaking eventually, and then the two lifts.
All right, let's stay on the topic of lifts here. Brian, I want to talk about Jordan 8 because last time you were on the pod, you hadn't even announced this yet. And I did host Stephen Kircher late 2022. And we talked about Jordan 8 because when Sunday River announced this lift, the Peanut Gallery was second guessing it, saying, well, that's not a busy part of the resort. And Kircher's whole philosophy was, yes, but they're not understanding redistribution and you are making this great new lift so that people will go ski it and go ski over there more. Curious, now that you've had Jordan 8 open for more than a year, has that in fact happened? Have you seen more skiers over on the Jordan part of Sunday River than you have historically?
Yes, is the simple answer to that, Stuart. Yes, 100%. That has changed the redistribution of how our guests ski the hill, their interest over there, the terrain over there. It has kind of put a little bit more excitement into that. It has been a really phenomenal addition to our resort on 100 different levels.
One of the most impressive to me, and I don't know if I would have appreciated this if I hadn't seen it firsthand, but when I was skiing there last year, it happened to be it was a pretty busy day. I think it was a Saturday or maybe a Friday when every upper mountain lift was closed on wind hold except for Jordan 8. And it was running a little slower than normal, but it was able to run all day long. And it really underscored the advanced technology that you're using here and how much more you were actually getting for your money. So talk about those wind resistant features of Jordan 8 and how this thing, you know, your biggest lift can power through the wind when all these other lifts that you have were not able to function.
Yeah, I think that even surprised us here operationally, to be honest. We were ready for a lift that could fight the wind, and that machine, there's a few reasons there. One, the way that machine is engineered, and it stays a little bit lower to the ground than the old Jordan, but the design and weight of those chairs is next level. I mean, that's a heavy chair. It's that bubble down gives it an aerodynamic property to it, and it really can fight winds. Like, I've been doing chairlifts for 26 years, and that is an unbelievable machine to fight the wind.
You gave me some stats last year, and I don't know if you have this off the top of your head or just give us a ballpark of how many days you lost in a typical season or the season before for the Jordan quad to wind holds, and then how many days you lost last season. Can you give us a sense of how much more efficient this lift is? Because I think it's not completely windproof. I think you still had to shut it down once in a while, but just if there's any kind of differential you can draw here.
Yeah, I think, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, Jordan was closed maybe upwards of 20% of the time. And now we are down to a day, a year.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's a complete game changer.
So Barker being a six pack, I would imagine the chairs weigh a little less. I don't know. Has Barker proven to be as wind resistant as Jordan?
Yeah. Yeah. We've had a lot of, you know, still only a few weeks. Well, I guess it's been more than a few weeks that we've had Barker open. But yeah, I think that has, the chairs are six, so they do weigh a little bit less, but it's the same design with the bubble and still the same lines of the bubble. And, you know, when putting that lift in, we always look at, you know, the profile of the lift, as we call it, and where that is in relation to tree line and wind protection. So once again, that thought process went into Barker 6. That coupled with the weight of the chair, the design of the chair, we are really happy with the way Barker 6 runs in the wind as well.
So right next to Jordan 8 is the odd, I think it's a fixed quad. I was there on a pretty busy weekend last year. I think it was the weekend after Presidents, and Oz wasn't spinning in spite of the fact that all your trails were open. There's a lot of snow cover. Was that an outlier? Was there something wrong with Oz that weekend? Or in general, did Jordan change the frequency with which you're going to spin the Oz lift?
Yeah, there was nothing that weekend. There's nothing wrong with the Oz chair. It's a great fixed grip chair. I do think we're understanding the way that Jordan 8 has changed the flow. I think the Oz chair still offers just some unbelievable skiing, right? I mean, the views from the top of Oz, that chair, what it makes accessible off of it, just Lost Princess and Flying Monkey and some of that more expert terrain in there certainly has a place. But with the flow of Kansas changing and the speed and uphill capacity of Jordan 8, there are just some days that chair is just not needed, but is, you know, 100% ready to go at a moment's notice.
So long term, you anticipate Oz continuing to be part of your lift ops?
Yes.
So one other big change that Jordan brought is it actually changed the way that you opened the resort for, I don't know, I want to say decades. Whitecap was kind of the opener, but you've shifted that. So talk about how you've changed the opening plan and how much of that is Jordan chair and how much of that is just, you know, you've been there 4 years now and you're starting to figure out a better way to do it.
Yeah, I think as the team looks at an opening plan, certainly with Barker being built this year, it's forced us to think a little bit differently because we've always opened with Barker. And that just, you know, we had an aggressive schedule to put that lift in. It wasn't scheduled to be ready to go for what we were hoping is an opening day of late October, early November. But another great thing about the Jordan is not only the lift, the reliability, the comfort, the speed, the uphill capacity. That pod of skiing is phenomenal. Lollapalooza, Rogue Angel, Excalibur. I mean, that's just some really good vertical, some great runs to open our season with. But we also had a huge increase in investment into our snowmaking system that gets water to the Jordan. So we last summer worked on getting more than almost over three times the amount of water that we historically have gotten up there. So we now got, you know, over 8,000 gallons a minute of water going to the top of Jordan in a frost-free line. So, I mean, you're really looking at that. And then when you start to bring in an awesome lift, low E technology, all of that water, the pumps and motors to get it there, we really feel that that's an opportunity and tried it this year as to be, that's our opening plan.
Do you have an elevation advantage down there? It's all an uphill drive there, and it's hard to tell on the trail maps to kind of flatten it out for a skier's perspective. But is it a little bit colder up there than it is down at the Summit Hotel?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So for perspective, the bottom of Jordan is approximately the same elevation as the mid station on the lock chair.
Mm. Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah, top of Jordan is about 3,200 feet. So we certainly have elevation and temperatures. That's some of the coldest temperatures we see early season is top of Jordan for sure, or at least that elevation.
All right. So big change to your early season opening plan. When Sunday River announced Jordan 8, Brian, it was pitched as a gateway lift that would eventually actually be more at the center of Sunday River rather than at the far end of it. There would be three additional peaks in what was called the Western Reserve. That was a couple of years ago. Just curious, do you have any update for us on the potential development on the Western Reserve, when we could start to see maybe some trail maps or some plans or some announcements or anything at all?
Yeah, I think, you know, as we look to the future, that is certainly a direction that we want to and are continuing to look at to develop. We have nothing short term in the next year or so to go that direction, but always knowing that that is land that we own, that we are working on, that we are, our engineering team is out there looking at different lines and plotting lifts and just kind of understanding that terrain. We continue to do that. We continue to brainstorm. We continue to work towards planning out there. So I think it is to come.
You know, there's a lot of terrain expansions opening up this year, big ones out west at Keystone and Steamboat and Aspen. There's been fewer terrain expansions in the east over the past several decades, although Boyne, to its credit, is opening two this year, one at Loon, a small one, and a really big one up at Sugarloaf. But in general, when I ask Eastern operators about expansions, the answer they give me is, well, we don't want a bunch of brown trails in February, right? Because sometimes you have good snow years and you have good coverage and you can open it. And other times, you know, it's President's Week and, you know, only a certain percentage of your terrain is open. So how much of that is a factor here, Brian, and just wanting to make sure that before you go into the Western Reserve and start developing that, you can take care of what Sunday River already has and make sure that that's 100% open?
Yeah, that certainly is a factor. And there's also the factor that as we continue to improve our infrastructure, whether it be snowmaking or power, low E technology, is that we are always keeping the core of what we need to get open for Christmas in this situation, but then building for our future, right? And I think that that's something that we focus a lot of our effort on before we install new snowmaking pipe or before we put in an 8-pack D-line chair, is that what will that look like in 3 to 5 years? What are we going to need out of that snowmaking system when we talked about getting additional water up to the top of Jordan? That's great for now, but eventually, if we do go west of that, is the infrastructure we're putting in now ready to handle and that growth that we are forecasting for over the next couple of years or the next, you know, infinitely? So we definitely spend a lot of time to make sure that as we're moving forward and as we're investing and as we're doing these things, that we're thinking long term or more infinitely about it.
Well, it seems like the investment at Sunday River never stops. 4 new chairlifts in the last 3 years, those 2 Merrill lifts that we discussed and those 2 D-lines that we discussed. Are you finished for a while, Brian? There's nothing else that I'm aware of that's been announced. You got anything in the hopper, anything you're thinking about for what could be the next chairlift upgrade?
Yeah, we've got nothing really set in stone at this point, Stuart. You know, I think this summer is going to be a lot of snowmaking infrastructure improvements. And we've got nothing on the agenda, the announced agenda, but we're always kind of thinking, you know, what is next and where are we going?
So for folks who are mining so the Sunday River 2030 plan for what could potentially be next, last I checked, that plan still mentions the Tempest lift as a potential next upgrade with a loading conveyor. I think that's lift 9, the white cap. I get confused in that end of the resort between lifts 9, 10, and 11. Yeah. So sorry, Sunday River folks, they turned me around. But is that still a near-term possibility to speed that lift up a little bit?
Yeah. You know, the loading conveyor technology, we have that on our spruce chair. We've had a lot of success with that. We also have it with the D-lines to, you know, get that line speed up on our detachables. That's certainly something we're looking at out of the white cap area. And, you know, as we look at lift upgrades, it's you know, focusing on Southridge has the Chandala, it has lift 2, which is another detach, you know, Jordan 8 out of the Jordan pod. Barker is high speed. So, you know, what are we, you know, really focusing on some of these access points for guest arrival and guest experience out of these base areas, if that's what they're looking to do, or, you know, to get to the next lift, or if that's their final destination for 5 or 6 runs, how do we make that uphill capacity the best we can and the best guest experience?
Yeah. So taking care of those portals first, you know, looking at the plan, Aurora lift 12, is listed as a midterm upgrade in your 2030 plan. What's the current thinking around Aurora and what we could see there eventually?
So I think as we look, you know, like we said, we got a D-line out of Barker and then the Chandala and then lift 2 and lift 6 with some detachable lifts. So as we're looking at that, we want to look at the guest experience as people travel from one point at our resort to another. right? So I think that, you know, is Aurora a fixed grip with a conveyor? Is it a detachable? It's got some great vertical. It's got some phenomenal skiing off of it. Are guests using it just to get to Jordan? Would that change if it was a detachable or had a loading conveyor? So there's a lot of, I'm sharing just a lot of our thought process, right, with you as to how we make these decisions to upgrade lifts across the resort.
You know, looking at the North and South Peak high-speed quads, those are both listed as long-term upgrades. And those lifts, I believe, date to the 90s. So older detachable technology and probably a lot of hours, especially on lift two. Just wondering what your current thinking is around those. That is where you tend to see lines at Sunday River, especially lift two and seven. So what's your thinking around where you would like to see those lifts evolve? Are we looking at six packs? What's your thinking around those two lifts?
Yeah, I think short term, just making sure that those machines are running as well as they are and supporting those machines to get people out of the base area. Adding three conveyors a couple years ago really changed the snow sports experience. And I think those conveyors, and then you couple that up with lift two and some of the terrain that's off of lift two with Broadway, right? Some of that beginner terrain and that beginner experience. I think it's important to have a detachable as part of that experience, knowing how, you know, we keep offering detachables across our resort. So I think it's a critical step, and lift two is great. It is one of our slower running detachable lifts that helps the snow sport end of things. We've increased chair spacing on that machine. So really looking at that as kind of a gateway into that next lift experience for our guests.
Boy, those carpets, I agree with you. That is a really underrated upgrade, especially as someone who, you know, my son is a stronger skier now, but when he was learning to ski, we would use those progression carpets, and they're really well designed. You know, I was out at Big Sky and they put in a double carpet, and I think they put one in at Summit at Snoqualmie too. Have you seen those? Is there anywhere at Sunday River you think you could use one of those double carpets? Because those are awesome.
Yeah, I'm excited to maybe at some point go to Big Sky and see that. I think I've seen one double conveyor. I really haven't had much experience with them, but I'm excited to see what that does for some of, you know, operationally as well, programmatically at Big Sky and some of the other resorts that we've put them in at. You know, I think those double conveyors are awesome. I think what really makes those great is that they're covered, right? That's a cool experience. You know, when your son's there and he goes into this conveyor and it's red and there's a tint to the view and there's no wind and reliability from an operational perspective, that is just such a neat part of that whole learn to or continuing to learn the ski process.
So last lift question for you here. There's still, for all the fancy new detaches you have, you do still have quite a few fixed grip quads. Looking at lifts like 10 and 11, White Heat, Little White Cap, no mention of those in the Sunday River 2030 plan. Does that mean you're happy with them and we can just expect the status quo down there? Or do you have other plans for those older fixed grip quads long-term?
You know, I think as we look at that, I think, you know, that loading conveyor piece, it certainly interests us, you know, getting those quads up a little bit faster, getting more reliability, less slows, less stops. So I think that's something that we're going to keep our eye on when we look at fixed grip lifts at the resort. But I think, you know, going back to those gateway, those access lifts, that's where you're going to see us focus some attention on. Whether it be with detachable technology or, you know, loading conveyor technology. So I love a fixed grip quad, right? And if we could just get another 50 feet per minute out of it with a loading conveyor, that can really be a real win.
So the 2030 plan overall seems like it's moving ahead of schedule. I mean, like I said, four new lifts in 3 years, and neither of those were actually even on the 2030 plan. I think maybe Merrill Hill was one Merrill Hill lift. So it seems very iterative in the way that Big Sky's 2025 plan has turned out to be, where you sort of announce these broad intentions and then just adapt to what the mountain needs at the moment while making that promise of investment. Just break this down for us. I mean, obviously I have a big interest in the lifts and the snowmaking and things like that, but talk to us about 2030 as a whole from your point of view, and how you're measuring that progress and what you see as the big achievement so far and what you would like to get finished next.
Yeah, I think we're comfortable with where we are to plan, right? And you mentioned a few things that were on the plan and a few things that weren't on the plan. But the beauty of that is our ability to be able to pivot and to expedite things or to hit pause on a few things or to really listen to our guests and say, hey, we need to pivot this. So I think having that plan out there, and it's always going to change. It's always going to morph. And there are factors that kind of drive that, whether it be operational or, you know, really listening to the guests and finding out that, hey, you know, we need to expedite this part of the plan. But I think one thing you're going to find with our plan is 9 times out of 10, it always starts with snow in snowmaking and providing that snow surface for our guests. And I think that, you know, having that be front and foremost on our mind is something that we don't take our eye off that prize, and that prize being our snow surface and our ability to make snow.
And definitely that's where my interest lies, is in the winter. I just know you've put a lot of effort into making Sunday River, evolving it into a Four Seasons resort. So tell us a little bit about kind of summer ops. And I know there was consideration of bringing the bike park back. Maybe it's even back. But tell us where you're at with that year-round stuff, the non-ski stuff, and how you're evolving toward that with 2030.
Yeah, we're excited, you know, for another summer here at Sunday River. Certainly golf is a big part of our summer, supporting our golf course and the team and all the guests that, you know, from our members to the weekend guests, to the midweek folks. So golf is certainly an integral part of our summer business. Weddings and conferences is certainly growing or coming back right after a COVID environment. So there's a lot of demand for that. We're seeing a lot of momentum going with that, with the two lodging properties. And with that comes, you know, Sunday River Outfitters offering paddleboarding, canoeing, you know, archery, chandala rides, really just trying to do some pieces there that make sense, that fit in with who we are and what we offer in the summer. So I think you'll see us to continue along that line, focusing on outdoor activity.
Any thought on bringing the bike park back?
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting to step back and look at mountain biking. Stuart, I tell you, I really wish I was a mountain biker. I'm not a bike guy, but I don't know. I really try. I try real hard. It's just not my balance, I guess. But, you know, where mountain biking was 10 or 12 years ago and where it has come is certainly right. I mean, you go to Loon and you experience that. Man, that's a manicure. That is awesome. The bikes that they have, it's a really different experience than maybe 10 or 15 years ago, where it was single track rocks and roots and gnarliness. And now there's this flow and it's manicured. So really understanding that as a product. And, you know, we certainly talk about mountain biking here. And I think that Loon is doing a really nice job with that. And Sugarloaf has a little piece of mountain biking as well. So making sure that, you know, as we look to grow summer, that we're complementing who we are and what we do here at the resort. But then also, you know, understanding where we fit in and understanding from, you know, Loon's success with that, how, if we get there, how could we do that as well?
All right, back to skiing. Let's talk Icon Pass. There's a perception that Sunday River is getting busier over time, particularly since joining the Icon Pass in 2018. I think maybe Boston folks used to think it was that their secret place, just a little farther away than the Ski 93 places. You know, that it's sort of like remembering snow when you were a kid, right? It's not always as much as maybe you thought it was. So is it true? Is Sunday River getting busier over time? And do you think the Icon Pass has any impact on that?
I think, you know, it's really interesting to look at Icon and where they are within our industry. I think that more so than that is just when people are choosing to ski, right? That remote work, that work from home, that midweek ski experience, I think that has changed in the short term, the past 3 years. That has really been where we've noticed some growth. And, you know, Icon is a part of that. Icon is a part of every day here at Sunday River. We have, you know, number of Icon guests. But I think we have no desire to get into right now a reservation system. When Sunday River has 19 lifts going, 900 acres, Blind Ambition is open, we still feel we have a comfortable capacity even on Saturdays.
How about the Mountain Collective? Sugarloaf, your sister resort in Maine, joined Mountain Collective a few years ago. I think Sunday River has all the attributes to fit right into that little country club. Have you considered that Mountain Collective?
Yeah, we certainly have thought about it. And I think right now, we feel offering a, you know, just a variety of different products specific to Sunday River or specific to Maine or specific to the same products that we offer on our, you know, our Gold Pass, where it's a pass that's good at Sunday River, Sugarloaf, and Loon. We just feel that, that having those be our own products and offering different levels of that is something that we're really comfortable. We're really seeing a demand for. So that's been our avenue with that.
So it seems like you're sticking with the New England Pass, which is that season pass at Sunday River, Loon, and Sugarloaf. Does not include Pleasant Mountain yet. Perhaps it will someday. That is the most expensive season pass in New England. The debut for the unlimited version, the gold version, was $1,359. It ended at $1,619, which I think it ended up going off sale after that. You know, I'm kind of surprised the Icon Pass doesn't cannibalize that a little bit, given 7 days at each of those three ski areas. I'm just curious how that product's going for you. Are you getting pushback on the prices, or are you comfortable and happy with that product where it is right now?
You know, this time every year, we're always looking at our product offering, right? And specific to the season pass and what the feedback is, what the demand is, and where we see this going. I think, you know, offering a great season pass, whether it be a with or without blackouts. But one thing that we really hear are some of the benefits that come with the pass, right? And whether it's buddy tickets or 15% off resort dining or retail or lodging or, you know, sister resort discounts. We see a lot of demand for that. So I think as you look at the pass and the accessible of skiing in New England, that's part of it. But that additional piece that is added onto that pass is something that we really think long and hard about that and listen to our customers and say, you know, what do they want out of this aside from the skiing? We've got a lot of our guests that love to bring friends up. They love to bring their friends up to their second home or their quarter share at the summit or the Grand Summit and share that with it. Because Sunday River is such a big part of their life. And being able to extend that to their guests, I think we get a lot of good feedback on that. So happy to continue to do that.
So I want to ask you the same question that I asked Mike Solomano, president of Killington. If you buy the Beast 365 Pass, which is their top ultimate season pass, you also get an Icon base pass. And if you buy the, I think it's the platinum version of the New England pass, you also get the Icon base pass. But what's been happening is certain operators have been leaving the Icon base pass. So those are some of the headliner mountains out west, like Alta and Aspen and Jackson Hole and Sun Valley and Snow Basin and Taos. Have you been hearing from your platinum New England pass holders complaints about the decline of value in that Icon base pass, that they are getting at a discounted rate if they buy that platinum New England, but you know, those are probably some of the reasons folks would want to do that upgrade in the first place. Have you heard any feedback from your pass holders about that?
Not really about you know, the resorts that Icon or the resort if they've chose to part ways or not participate in that. I do think that Icon grouping is still pretty large. It's still pretty excessive, right? They've got a lot of presence in a lot of the West Coast or the Western skiing markets. So I haven't heard much negative feedback about that. And I think that as I look at it, there's still some unbelievable destinations that guests can frequent with that Icon pass.
So I do want to acknowledge, Brian, that while Sunday River and the New England pass is the most expensive in the region, you actually have a bunch of tiers of this. So there's non-holidays versions, there's midweeks versions, there's a whole bunch for students and youth options, and those are quite a bit cheaper. And I mean, I would love to see versions of this at the Icon level, and Epic actually has done a pretty good job with this too of offering that midweek New England pass. But just talk about the logic here and why Sunday River and your sister resorts have really crafted this pass suite that really values that premium access on the upper end, but then actually gives options for just about anyone who wants to ski to be able to also be a pass holder.
Yeah, you know, you've got platinum, you've got silver, you've got gold, you've got nitro and students passes in there. And then I think if you couple those more season-long pass options with some of the 2, 3, 4, 5 day passes, you know, the theory is there is to really have something for all types of guests, right? We've got some people that just want to ski here at Sunday River, or they just like the New England Boyne resorts, or, you know, hey, we're just midweek. We're just going to go bronze this year. So I think really having that, the right product for the person who's looking to purchase, I think that is certainly the goal out of the gate, right? And it's to make that lifelong skier, and hopefully they're a Sunday River skier, damn it. But you know, really getting that product that allows them the flexibility to enjoy Sunday River or all of our resorts here in New England, or even, you know, at some of the gold, right? You're allowed, you have the accessibility to go out to Brighton. You have the accessibility to go out to a Big Sky and enjoy a couple of days of skiing, and then it's 50% off. So really just trying to have a really solid product offering.
So on that note of making lifelong skiers, Sunday River launched something called the Community Access Pass last year. This is a super cool program. Tell us about this pass, why you launched it, and how it's going so far.
Yeah, so that Community Pass is really being launched by the River Fund. They are the administrators of the pass. It is a community-based pass that goes through an absolutely phenomenal organization called the River Fund, and they have parameters on the Community Pass, and that is, it is a season pass, good at Sunday River, and it's good for the kids in the MSAD 17, SAD 44, RSU 10, so just the local school communities, and it's a pre-K through 12 are eligible for it, and it is all, we donate the passes, and it is managed by the River Fund to get, there is a income base that the River Fund sets up, so students that fall into that category can get free skiing or riding.
Amazing. Great program. That's a good thing to walk off on. Brian, I cannot thank you enough for the time. I appreciate the relationship. I appreciate everything you're doing at Sunday River. Now I just got to get up there and ride that Barker lift myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you blew us off for the opening day. So we're expecting to see you here, Stuart, at some point. Love having you here. Love the program. And I really thank you for including me on this. It certainly is an honor to talk to you and, you know, be able to get in touch with the listener group. So thank you for including me.
You got it, Brian. Thank you. That's Brian Heon, general manager of Sunday River, Maine. To all my listeners, I want to acknowledge that this one took quite a bit longer to get to you than normal. In fact, it took almost a couple of months. There were two reasons for that. One, we recorded this episode the day before I discovered a pretty serious health issue that derailed my schedule for quite some time. You can read all about that on stormskiing.com if you're curious. But the second reason that this one took a little longer is that we had some technical difficulties retrieving the recording. This was on my end with the recording platform I use, but due to a glitch in the system, it fell on Brian to retrieve the audio file. It was, frankly, a real pain in the ass for him. But he stuck with it, and I appreciate that diligence so much. I mean, he's the general manager of Sunday River. You think he didn't have better things to do than mess around with my stupid audio files. But he stuck with it, and there you go. A little late, but we got it done. Brian, thank you very much for sticking with me on that one. I'm sure all the listeners will appreciate that conversation. And I appreciate you. Thank you all very much for listening. Getting caught up on the pod here. New England, I already have episodes recorded with the leaders of Okemo, Tenney, and Gunstock. Wildcat and Mount Sunapee are scheduled for this spring. I also have a ton of Western stuff ahead. Going hard into BC with eps focused on Panorama, Fernie, Whistler, and Cypress. Also plenty of Western US on deck, with Sugar Bowl, Jackson Hole, Kirkwood, and A-Basin all ahead. To hear those podcasts as soon as they are live, please visit stormskiing.com and subscribe to the Storm Skiing newsletter. New podcasts will appear in your email box several hours before syncing with the podcast services, including Apple and Spotify. There are free and paid tiers of the newsletter, and paid subscribers receive podcasts 7 full days before everyone else. You can also follow the Storm on Twitter and Instagram at Storm Ski Journal. Until next time, stay well, stay safe. I'm Stuart Winchester, and I will talk to you again very soon.
The Storm Skiing Podcast is a Quicksilver Films production.